I think we'll start the meeting. Obviously, we don't have a quorum, and I don't think we're ever going to get a quorum today, given the weather. And but we can't vote anyway. So what I'm going to suggest that we're going to send an email to all the members of the committee and ask them to prioritize and let me know what their priorities are, how they want to rank all the projects. So we're going to start first with the Human Services bonding recommendations, and we have folks from MSOP first, and then we're going to hear from the department.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Morning.
I believe the bill that we're hearing is House File 1766, which is a capital investment request for $90 million for the implementation of Phase 2 at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake. I know, Mr. Chair, that you are familiar with the project and with the situation, being that you're a co-author of the bill. I thought I'd remind you that. but to describe the current situation, I have with me at the table Sir Dennis Benson, who is the executive director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And I'd just like to turn it over to him to describe where we are with this, with the project and the situation that is implied by it.
Okay, Mr. Benson, would you state your name for the record there? And
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. We're here today to go through a very short PowerPoint to kind of help you understand what's driving the need for this $89 million appropriation. It's, as Representative Hilty indicated, it's the first priority for the department, and Alan Van Buskirk will be going through the other four departmental needs here in a few moments, but again, to summarize, it's an $89 million request for just MSOP up at the Moose Lake facility. And what this project will give us is not only 400 additional beds. We believe we're going to be out of beds by mid to late 2012, and Mr. Storkamp will go into some detail on projections here in a moment. But it will also add the critical support space, treatment rooms, kitchen, dining area, and some of those things that were not included in the Phase 1 project where we simply just bonded 400 beds. And these are critical needs because we really are, as you know, we are compelled to treat these people. We're required to treat anybody who wants treatment. And given our current situation, we simply don't have adequate treatment rooms. We don't have the infrastructure space. We're operating out of a kitchen that was designed for 100 clients. Today, we just crossed over the 400 mark threshold, so we're about four times what that kitchen was designed for. Those are just two issues that come to mind, but there are many. As you also know, it's courts in, courts out. We don't determine who comes, and we also don't determine when it's time for them to leave. That's a court process. And again, the population began to increase back in about 2003. So I'd like to ask Mr. Storkamp now to kind of walk you through population projections, which really is the driving element for this project.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Center Program. The chart that's on the screen here shows our population as it's growing. over the, what has grown over the last several years. From 2003 to 2009, we saw a dramatic increase in the population of our civilly committed sex offenders. Looking at projections moving forward, we're looking between 60 and 70 per year growth in this program. This is actually down slightly from last year's projections, which showed 70 to 80 per year growth. And the change really came down to changes in the Department of Corrections, actually in the number of releases coming from the Department of Corrections. So we're kind of looking at some different factors, and I'll show you a couple of those factors moving forward. In addition, we've got about 70 individuals that are duly committed between the Department of Corrections and the Sex Offender Program, and are actually housed at the Department of Corrections that will eventually be coming back to the program. The next slide really shows the projections now as a line going up, and the bars are actually showing where we're going to be housing our clients. The base, or the black bars, are showing our population at Moose Lake and St. Peter's, so kind of the core. The white area that you see from 2007 to 2009 was space that we rented from Department of Corrections, their annex. We had almost 200 individuals in that program, or in that facility at one point. And when we opened our new 400-bed facility in July of 2009, it was completely, or it was half full the day that we opened it, because we moved the clients from the annex over. As you can see from the yellow bars, 2012 or late 2012 is when we're going to start running out of beds with the current projections. And the 400 beds with a 24-month build would come online just about that same time when you need them. A couple of factors that go into the projections. If you take a look at the next chart, these are the number of criminally sexual conduct sentences that were given each year from sentencing guidelines. This is kind of the court process way back even before the civil commitment process starts. You can see that we've had a pretty steady number between 580 and 590 per year from 2004 to 2008. It really doesn't show any sign of increasing or decreasing. It's a pretty much a standard rate coming in. On the next slide, we looked at first degree only. And about 100 to 150 cases per year are coming in on first degree. But notice the length of sentences here. They're coming, about 70% of them are coming to prison, 70-75%. And they're coming with 160-month sentences. That means they're going to do that prison term first. That means we're not even evaluating them for this program for 10 to 15 years. And at that point, they would then be eligible for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So we have quite a lot of, in the pipeline, if you will, of not only those that are currently in the Department of Corrections serving their time, but as you can see from the chart here, a steady flow coming in as well. One of the bright sides in the numbers that we've seen, and that's some of why our projections have gone down slightly, is if you take a look at the number of referrals from the Department of Corrections. Again, a dramatic increase in 2003, where all level 3s and other sex offenders were referred, to about 150 on average, but we noticed in 2009, just got those numbers in, that it's 114. So we're seeing slightly less. About 50% of these on average are coming to our program through the courts process.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to continue now in the next couple of slides, but just to give you some perspective here on what's been happening with the program in other areas of growth, there is some good news with respect to staffing. When we went from 3 physical plants to 2, we did see lots of efficiencies. We've reduced a little over 200 positions through attrition in the last couple of years. So we went from about 900 staff down to 700. During that same period in time, we went from 384 clients up to about 583. So those two trends are positive with respect to what we're paying on this program. The next slide is simply our annual budget. We did not include the deficiency request in this bar graph, but again, you can see we're about $10 million cheaper than we were in 2008, and again, that's a good thing. We've also been under pressure to take a hard look at our per diem and see if we can get that down. This is a very expensive program. As you know, we are required to treat anybody that wants treatment. We have over 80% now that are involved in productive treatment. That's up from about 50% 5-6 years ago. And that all costs money. But again, the good news here is We went from $387 a day, as stated per diem back in 2007, to $328 a day this fiscal year. When this Phase 2 project is completely full, in today's dollars, we'll be at about $250 a day. And again, that compares reasonably favorably with the other states at the bottom of this chart. I'd also just make mention of the, a handout that should be in your file. It's a fiscal summary that goes into more detail on what's been happening with the expenditures and some of the census pieces for this program. The next slide goes into some detail what we include in that per diem. The top half of this page just underscores the operational costs. That is $303 a day. It's actually about $25 less than our total per diem if we add in all of the other allocations, statewide indirect, DHS indirect, building depreciation, bond interest, et cetera. We add another $25. I'd also just remind you that many of the other states in the previous slide that we compared to don't include those additional costs. So our per diem includes every nickel that we spend in this program, both directly and indirectly, and we've broken it down into some detail for you. The next slide is just simply the site. You see MSOP main building in kind of the middle of this slide. That's the original building, started as 100 beds. A couple years later, they added an additional 50. So there's 150 there. In the MSOP Complex 1, that's the 400-bed building that we opened this past July. And Phase 2 would be in the middle left of the page if and when that is bonded and constructed. Next page goes into a little detail, again, what we're really adding to the physical plant. And again, in addition to those additional 400 beds, that infrastructure space is just critical to support about 950 clients when we have both units full. Treatment rooms, food service, health service, mental health, laundry, canteen, property, education, security offices, vocational work, and then, of course, warehouse storage for the physical plant. And this next slide, Mr. Storkamp will summarize again, but this kind of gives you some perspective where we started, where we're at, and where we need to be.
Mr. Chair and members, what you see on the slide here is really the life and program safety essential space. This really is to support 950 individuals. But as you can see, our original design, which was for 100 clients, showed about 160,000 square feet in food service, treatment rooms, health service, physical plant area, and we actually increased by 50 within that existing physical plant to 150, and now today we're at 400 with the addition of Phase 1 beds without changing any of that infrastructure or that life safety essential space. And our clinical director talks about her one treatment room that was added, and she's very proud of that. We need multiple treatment rooms that I'll show you in a moment. But what we really need is over 500,000 square feet in support services space for our clients moving forward. Again, food services, the essential type of things that come with this program. Part of our main building design really was to have five treatment rooms. When we added Complex 1, we added one additional treatment room because there's no other treatment rooms in that infrastructure space. We've had to put temporary rooms and convert some offices into small treatment rooms that aren't really conducive to our treatment component. As such, moving into the next phase, Phase 2, that adds that space, we're talking about 50 additional treatment rooms and programming rooms that are needed in order to accommodate the clientele that we have for our program.
Mr. Chair and members, if anybody has any questions on this piece, we're happy to answer them. Otherwise, we can move on to Mr. Van Busker.
Representative Salza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall 2 years ago when we visited this with the Capital Investment Committee, and I think the question at that time was related to the construction of the building and the needs that it's going to be placing on the future of that area as far as energy. And the question at that time was, are we looking at energy efficient buildings and or the use of other types of heating and cooling that may be placing less strain on the community's assets. And can you answer that question? Has anything been, that was 2 years ago we asked the question, and I don't know if anything's changed or if you use that indication from the committee or what's been done with that.
Mr. Bensley.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have Alan Van Buskirk here who has been working with the architects on not only that issue but many issues around construction. And yes, he can certainly give you some technical terms, but certainly energy efficiency has been a consideration. We have, I think, also looked at, you know, what does and doesn't work well in that phase one complex, trying to work with the local municipality too in terms of getting the electrical load out to the site is another issue that people need to understand. And I understand that it's not only electrical but sewer. They have expanded their sewer capacity. They're in the process of doing that now. They're also in the process of bringing out an additional, I believe it's a transformer that's going to be upwards of about $3 million so that we can adequately provide electrical load to this addition. But in terms of some of those details, I defer to Alan to answer some of those questions. But certainly there has been, we've been mindful of window location, energy efficient ballast, heat circulating and recirculating pumps in the structure that are consistent with what you would put in a building built in not only this climate but in 2010-2011.
I represent Stalzi.
I think the question 2 years ago was, have you looked at having geothermal heat for the future lowered operating costs of the facility and the less needs for the local community?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Alan Van Buskirk from the agency to respond to that question.
Mr. Chairman, members, excuse me. My name is Alan Van Buskirk, Facilities Director for State Operated Services. I've been assisting Minnesota Sex Offender Program on the project. And I believe it was last year there was a question during committee about this when we made the presentation about the renewable use, and we really didn't have a good answer at that point in time. Since that time, we've been working with the architect and the engineers on the project, and we're moving forward with design to provide solar photovoltaic renewables, hopefully to meet the 2% guidelines in the statutes. Does that address your question, Representative?
Somewhat. Yes, there is no answer coming.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I have a maybe more some more backing up a little. I think these are great questions about the energy issues. I just can't believe we build anything anymore in this state without really doing that to the extent we possibly can. But I want to back up a little bit because, first of all, going back to the annual budget slide, Mr. Benson, you mentioned that the deficiency isn't in there. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, thank you for mentioning that it's not in there, but why the heck isn't it in there, and what would it be if it was in there?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Benson,
Representative Liebling, I'm going to again ask Mr. Storkamp to respond to that. He's telling me that there is a piece of that in there.
Madam Chair, Representative, the chart actually does include the deficiency. These are the actual costs for fiscal year 9 and 8. So that was the biannual fiscal year from this last year.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, so it is in there. Okay, that's one question that I had. The other thing, I just have to say, with all deference to the very distinguished authors of this bill. Now, this is an enormous problem for this state, and I have to say I feel very, very troubled by this request, because this is a program, you know, notwithstanding the way it's been presented, the growth in these figures and the need here is not an act of God. The need here is a result of state policies. And you know and I know that we have more people in this program than most other states. And, you know, we're on a trajectory here that I just don't know where it's going to end. And it really, you know, it really pains me that we're talking about bonding $90 million for this, to take care of this growth that's just, you know, going to continue. I mean, this is not where I want to be spending the state's money. I really don't. I want to be building colleges. I want to be building healthcare facilities. I don't want to be building places to store people forever and try to treat them for being sex offenders. I mean, this just doesn't seem to me to be a really good use of our resources, and this isn't the way we ought to be doing it. And having said that, I understand that this is, you know, the need is going to be there if we just keep on the way we're going. So I'm wondering if, I noticed you didn't bring today the slides that show how we compare in our civil commitments with other states, both in terms of raw numbers and per capita. And I wonder if you could just address that for a minute, because this committee really has to grapple with that. Well, other committees really need to grapple with it perhaps more. But, you know, just to look at this as though, wow, we've got this aging population, we've got to provide for them, and that's kind of all we can do. I just, you know, I hope we're going to reject that approach. So my, you know, my question is, you know, give us those figures. And then, have you given any consideration to maybe phasing this program to give us some time to do something else to head off these huge numbers so that we can spend our resources in a more productive way?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you've asked several questions, and they're certainly good questions, fair questions, and not unusual questions. We've only been at this now a couple of hearings, and we've sort of heard it before. We heard it last year. I heard it the year before. I would again say that while I'm not trying to wash my hands of policy issues, these are policy decisions. Again, it's courts in, courts out. We don't decide who needs to come to this program. The courts do. The courts decide when they're ready to go home. Our piece in this is to create a treatment program that is constitutionally sound, that's valid, that uses best practices, and hopefully will result in some people moving through. So I really need to push back a little bit on the legislature to take another look at this policy. I would also submit that this is an unusual growth curve when we really didn't change any policy. It was a change of practice more than a change of policy. In terms of sex offenders coming to prison, there were policy decisions made there, but basically the county attorneys and the judges chose to civilly commit more people in the last 8 years, 7 years, than they did prior to that. Department of Corrections referred more for consideration, but they didn't make decisions either. They simply referred them for consideration. So I think there are good policy questions that need additional discussion. With respect to your other question, we are the largest program per capita in America. We have the largest number coming into a civil commit program, and I think there are 20 programs now in the United States. We are number three in terms of just raw folks, next to only California and Florida. So we do have a large program. Again, as Mr. Storkamp indicated, those numbers are starting to relax a little bit, but not dramatically. And I do think that the numbers will continue to come down from year to year, but again, I think that's going to be a slow come. I don't think it's going to happen in the next year or two or three. As Mr. Storkamp indicated, we're going to be full in 2012, and unless we stop the train tomorrow, we need beds. We absolutely have to have beds. I would also say that I wasn't here, but my understanding is when phase one was bonded, there was a push to try to get some corresponding infrastructure. It was a decision was made at that time to phase it. And we had conversation in the years subsequent to that to start to get additional dollars. So nothing has happened now from 2006 until 2000. Here we sit in 2010. So the notion of phasing becomes less and less of a possibility. We have really painted ourselves into a corner in terms of not only infrastructure but beds. And it really becomes a tough, tough choice if you're going to do part of the infrastructure. I really believe that we have some vulnerability in the eyes of the courts. In terms of beds, the deal that we had with corrections is no longer available. Now, are we going to need all 400 beds the day we open? No, we probably aren't. But the reality is trying to phase in beds in a construction like this, we call it a star building, it becomes difficult. And if you're only going to build half of that, then we're talking about additional costs for inflation. We're talking about additional costs inside of, or at least partially inside of a secure perimeter, which is also a cost driver. So those are considerations as well. Now, are there other discussions that the legislature could have? Certainly, but those are also tough choices. When you look at the profile of these 400 or 500 folk, they're not first-time sex offenders. Many of them have multiple victims, upward of 50 to 100. I reviewed one that was over 130 here recently. So these are out of the 18,000-19,000 registered sex offenders. These are the 580 that really kind of fall through all the screens. So they are a challenging crowd. We have done some things that I think are innovative and are in keeping with trying to divert some people responsibly from civil commitment. And one of the big pieces is the joint program that we have with the Department of Corrections. We have 50 beds at the prison at Moose Lake that we treat. My staff go over and provide treatment to these folks who have been earmarked as probably on the path to civil commitment unless we give them some good treatment. And that program is starting to catch hold a little bit, and hopefully we'll see some results from that. And again, I think that's in keeping with public safety. I think it's in keeping with treating people in a much cheaper environment and trying to prevent the problem before civil commitment. But those things all take some time to develop. And I think you're asking the right questions. I'm not taking issue with your questions, but you know, this train has left the track or station rather, and we're in dire straits in terms of treatment space and the need for beds. So I think we can slow it down. I don't know that we can turn it around.
Representative Stallings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us an update of what's happening on the federal level? There's a test case that's moving, and the Supreme Court may be hearing it. I'm not sure just what the status is of that process and how it might affect the state of Minnesota in the future with what we're doing as well.
Mr. Best.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not going to pretend to be one. My understanding of that case is it really is a federal issue, and it probably will not have any impact on the states. The issue, as I understand it, is can the federal government civilly commit sex offenders? The states have asked that, but at least Minnesota, that question has been run up the flagpole on two occasions, and the courts have determined that yes, we can. So I don't know. First of all, the oral arguments were heard, I believe, this past month. We're waiting for a decision, but first of all, if the decision may very well be yes, they can, then it becomes a moot issue. But even if the decision is no, they can't, what I hear from our attorneys is it will be unlikely that it would impact our civil commitment laws.
Could you move on to your second bill, Mr. Hilty? Wait a minute. Representative Abler first.
Actually, just two questions, and I know this is an ongoing discussion about the whole program, but just to the bill, and the price of it, 89 million, is that, it was supposed to go up this year, but it didn't do it last year. It sounds like that, is that the number that was last year, too, or is it something more than last year?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, last year the cost was $96 million, almost. Yeah. 96 and a half, I believe, 96.4. We did cost out inflation, current inflation with this project. We have also streamlined a couple small areas inside the footprint and brought the cost down about $7 million.
And also a good time to be building because
yeah.
Prices are going down.
Yeah, lots of things are coming in under budget. And Mr. Chair, just to a comment to the whole program here, and we don't have the time to dissect all this, but I think that given all the projections of state revenues and expenses and desires, there's got to be, I think it's time for someone to look at this who's really smart about this, the department or some other group, and bring us some, you know, a plan here and give county attorneys advice. You know, you don't hear that Wisconsin is being overrun by sex offenders, and maybe they are, but I don't know that. But and that only California and, you know, Minnesota are safe. And I respected all your treatment, and I understand what you're trying to do with these folks. And there wasn't much treatment offered, you know, in the 1990s, and maybe that was, we were harmed by that. But I think as we make harder choices, we need to find a way to look at you know, the whole pipeline and all of that, while we protect the integrity of what you've got and treat these people where they can be treated. And it may be not a very politically popular thing to do, but I think it, Rooks and Liebling, I think, said it pretty well. And if this is the answer, that this is what we get to do, this is, then we can embrace that and move on. Right? Just like a year for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things, both are comments. One is in terms of Representative Scalzi's question earlier. I think she specifically asked about geothermal, and I found that the answer that was given didn't even touch on that. More importantly, an answer that says we met the basic minimal state guideline isn't an answer to me in today's world with what we can achieve with energy efficiency, and particularly with the, as you say, the distinguished offer you have a bill. And so I'd really appreciate this if you all go back to work on that topic to give us a better answer as to all the efforts you've made to try to have long-term design elements that would lead to savings over time. I mean, even new homes going in my district are all, you know, many of them are going with geothermal in their own homes now. So it just seems like the state needs to take a lead on this. So I would like to hear much more efforts to go beyond some minimal in terms of building a brand new facility in terms of energy conservation. Secondly, on the broad topic that's been raised about just the numbers of people that keep coming to the system, I would be interested, if not this session during the interim, for having a joint session with public safety and getting the county attorneys and getting the judges in to speak to us as to and to look at all the data as to, as Representative Abler has raised, in terms of what is the net benefit we're receiving from all this investment and can we document it? Or do we need to change course and not keep increasing this pipeline? So given that we need to do that quickly, as you said, because the transportation in terms of the current growth and need, you know, as soon as we can pull that together, I think we should. I know this is not the primary purview of most of us in health and human services, what we like to spend our time on, but I think given the amount of money going into this area and amount we'll have to cut in other areas of great importance to each of us, that we need to, unfortunately, take this project on to become more knowledgeable on this area. And then finally, a comment in terms of the answer about the bonding amount from last year this year. I had a project that a year and a half ago for my district was bid 30% more than it actually cost this last year to do. That is because of the construction trades and the industry and all that, and it's, you know, it's a third of what they thought it was going to cost in terms of what we were bonding for originally, and so huge savings
have been obtained just because of the market, not having to do with redesign or the inflation rate, but just because the cost of bidding it has come down so much because of people competing for that work. So I'm wondering, in your case, where has that come into play, and why has the number not been lowered as a result of that? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we recently asked the same organization that works with MMB on costing of all costs to reevaluate our program based on current figures. The $96 million was based on, I think, $97 or $98, 2007, 2008 dollars. So in their repricing, they came up with about $1 million less in that process, but it also negated any inflation for the last 2 years in that process. So you're absolutely right that there were some reductions in the overall cost, but it has been recosted just this past month.
For Representative Murphy, and then we're going to move along.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for the department staff and for the others that may be before us today. I'm wondering if you've been able to do any sort of estimate on what these proposals, if funded, would produce in terms of jobs for Minnesotans.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair and members, the project itself will be about 200 additional positions in the facility for clinical security operations of the program, and that doesn't count any of the impact on the community by having the additional staff there. The other aspect of our project is that it is shovel-ready, so the day that the bill is signed, if it is funded, we could begin contracting out. We actually also went with a contract management at risk, which Department of Admin has the authority to do. We're bidding that out currently, so we will have that person on board and available to start the day that the bill is signed. Again, speeding up the time, allowing us to shorten the construction time and help lower our costs.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that. I'm wondering if you have a sense of potential jobs produced with the construction itself.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm hearing from the gallery here in Allen Van Buskirk that it would be about 200 to 300 individuals on site at any given point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hilty, do you want to tell us about the House File 2436?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2436 is a request for approximately $2.5 million that would be related to the Phase 2 project that we have just been discussing. This would be for the city of Moose Lake, for Moose Lake Power and Light Authority, to provide at least some of the funding for an upgrade in the municipal electric system, specifically a substation located near the MSOP and the corrections facilities in Moose Lake, to handle the additional load for the project that goes forward.
Representative Hilty, is that for the electrical part or for the sewer part?
It's solely for the electrical upgrade. The water and sewer upgrades are already taking place and are funded.
And do you know if this is sort of standard that the community, Yosemite builds a new development, housing development, who pays for putting in the infrastructure? Is that the developer or is it the city?
Mr. Chair, I do have some representatives from Moose Lake here that perhaps could address that question better than I, but my understanding is that typically it would be the developer that pays that cost. And, of course, in this case, the developer really would be EHS.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Yeah, and I appreciate you coming forward, and I, as a city that owns its own muni, I understand local costs, and I guess I'm just, you know, the whole bonding process, it just seems to just all be part of one bill and that they should have to do this anyway. Has that been, has DHS expressed their willingness to try to find a way to work with you on this, or are they thinking we'll just plug it in and let the city take care of it, or do you want to offer a comment about that? I'm being that's a supportive comment of your project.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, certainly we've had that discussion. I believe the the representatives of MSOP feel somewhat limited by what the administration is willing to recommend. It's my feeling that this should be included as something that is a cost that would have to be borne by the community otherwise. And one of the sort of unique features of the Moose Lake community is that relative to the size of the institutions there, there's a major correctional facility as well as the current MSOP facility. There's a very limited tax base to support any kind of infrastructure projects without the kind of help that would be needed from the major institutions there. It's a real problem in the community. It's kind of landlocked by state land and state facilities.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks. I know you know something about energy and so on a little bit. If this weren't passed, if they built the thing without this, without 2436 passing, would that be borne by the locals then in terms of higher rates? Would that be the otherwise choice?
That's my understanding. That, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I think I would call on one of the representatives from the community to get into some of those details. Looks like that will be Mr. Dave Talbot, who is the Moose Lake City Manager.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, in response to that question, if there is not an appropriation of capital bonding funds made by the state legislature, the city is still going to be required to do this massive upgrade just to provide basic electrical services to the state facility. In that case, the city of Moose Lake would have to issue general obligation revenue bonds and becomes a classic case for the state of either pay now or pay later. If the city were to bond, obviously our ability to issue debt and to have that debt issued at a lesser rate than the state is marginal at best. So effectively it's going to cost the state probably an additional $25,000 per month in their electrical bill if the city had to issue that debt exclusively.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I visited with the Capital Investment Committee twice, the Moose Lake area, and I know this year we looked in the buildings and visited with some of the people being treated, but 2 years ago we met mainly with the city officials, and it was my understanding at that time, and you can correct me if this is a wrong understanding, but it was my understanding that there was sufficient power available for this facility. But for the city of Moose Lake was looking at if they had another possible development come in, all of the power would have been used by this facility. So you were really looking for the future developers coming in, and you were wanting capacity for that to happen and to be able to provide that additional capacity. Has that changed at this time?
Mr. Chairman. Representative, yes, at the time when you visited the city of Moose Lake, and thank you very much for visiting with us, what we were discussing at that time was the need for electrical generation and transmission improvements based on knowing that phase two was being proposed and may come forward. So we were already planning and ahead for the second phase. Presently, that south substation, which services for the most part the Department of Corrections and the Department of HHS facilities in our community, we're now at 100% capacity.
and therefore it's a requirement that we do this expansion for our electric utility service, in that it takes 2 years from the date we get approval to ordering the equipment that needs to be installed.
Representative Scalzi.
Just as a follow-up, then if you're having the additional capacity, and I'm assuming that it wouldn't all be used by DHS, then if you had additional capacity and had other private developers come in who would be using that capacity, then would they then reimburse the state or somehow make this whole if they're going to be using this extra capacity that we would be paying for?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the way that it actually works now is before we started phase one, we actually had reserve capacity at the South Substation. Effectively, with the construction of phase one, we are borrowing our reserve capacity to the state at this time. So effectively, by doing this expansion, we recover the reserve that we originally had and we need for the operations of the city, and also if there are future expansions and growth.
Okay, any further questions? I don't see any, so thank you, Representative Hilty, and we're going to send get priorities from the committee and send it on to the bonding committee. And next
Mr.
we
Chair,
have...
Thank you very much, members of the committee.
Mr. Van Busker, to briefly tell us what the what else the Department of Human Services is requesting in the bonding bill.
Chairman, members, Alan Van Busker, Facilities Director, State Operating Services. I'll present priorities 2 through 5 from the Department of Human Services 2010 capital budget request. I'll start out with system-wide asset preservation. This is Department's second priority. This request will impact 5 DHS facilities, including Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, Standard Regional Human Services Center, Minnesota Extended Treatment Options at MITO, at Cambridge, St. Peter Regional Treatment Center, and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, Moose Lake Campus. The key objective of asset preservation is to preserve, is to reduce the amount of deferred maintenance and deferred renewal. Each of our department's facilities are responsible for maintaining a list of projects required to preserve and improve their physical plant assets on a 6-year plan format. This list currently outlines asset preservation projects with an estimated cost which totals over $27 million. Most of these projects involve significant level of repair and replacement. Because of the system-wide magnitude, cannot be addressed with the current level of repair and replacement funding in the agency's operating budget. A list of the facility's asset preservation projects is available for review and consideration. These projects include security, safety, and code compliance, life and fire safety deficiencies, emergency power egress and egress lighting upgrades, roof repair and repair and replacement, and structural deficiencies, duct pointing and other building envelope work, road and parking lot maintenance, major mechanical and electrical utility system repairs, replacements, upgrades, and other improvements, including repair and replacement of boilers, chillers, and the related HVAC equipment, energy efficient improvements, and abatement of hazardous materials. The department requested $5 million for system-wide asset preservation for 2010, and the governor recommended $3 million in his budget. The department's third priority is
Mr.
Greater
Chair? On that one of the items you mentioned was security and safety.
Right.
And you're talking about employee safety with regard to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we're talking about different aspects of training, but some of the safety, but some of it would include the installation of and or replacement of obsolete manned down systems, systems that are personal safety devices that protect or that alarm when a staff member would be in trouble. They either push a button or if they go board down for 10 seconds without disarming it, it sounds an alarm at a station. It activates on the screen where that trouble code is, and there is an immediate problem. That's just one example.
And Mr. Chair, and the reason I'm asking is that I understand there's been a significant, really, really significant increase in the number of injuries at some of the state-operated service facilities, including St. Peter, but other places as well. And I'm just wondering if this, if there's a larger plan here to assist in reducing those levels of inmate, or not inmate, patient-caused injuries.
Mr. Van Busker.
It's, security issues that will also include the installation of cameras and television, cameras and monitoring systems in the various facilities. Our new facilities, that we refer to as the Community Behavioral Health Hospital, CBA, all have these systems, and they seem to be doing an awful lot to reduce the amount of patient injuries to staff and patient injuries to patients.
And Mr. Chair, is there any other part of that other than just investing in technology? Has the department come up with a plan to address what is really a significant increase in staff injuries over the last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that the department has implemented additional training for intervention and for determining when a patient is becoming agitated, and to introduce intervention sooner than they have communicated.
And Mr. Chair, what about staffing levels? What about staffing levels?
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're asking for increasing staffing levels?
I'm just wondering if that's part of the plan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I do not believe that.
And Mr. Chair, I guess the question is the department... has a plan come together specifically to address these increases in injuries?
Mr. Van Busker.
I think that they are working on that, but they don't have the plan. I'll take this question down.
All right, thank you.
A better answer for you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, the department's third priority is the Brainerd Campus Redevelopment, Reuse, and Demolition Project. This request is a continuation of the department's previous system-wide capital request for capital redevelopment, reuse, and demolition. This system-wide request was first introduced in 2005 and originally focused on four regional treatment centers, Iowa Ching, Fergus Falls, Wilmer, and Brainerd. Brainerd is the remaining campus associated with this multi-year request. The other three campuses have been acquired or transferred to other non-state entities and are in various stages of reuse and redevelopment. The goals are to facilitate redevelopment and reuse of the Brainerd campus and to reduce or eliminate expenditure of operating funds for utilities and maintenance of vacant non-utilized buildings and infrastructure. Crowing County and the City of Brainerd have indicated that they are not interested in owning or managing the redevelopment of the Brainerd campus of the existing non-functional buildings. The primary focus of this project is to abate hazardous materials, demolish the vacant non-utilized buildings and infrastructure that we have not been able to attract others for potential reuse or redevelopment. The current campus operational costs exceeds $1 million per fiscal year. This expense provides heat and cooling to three program buildings. Heat and cooling to Building 1, that's the old administration building, and minimal heat to vacant buildings, and basic building and grounds maintenance for the campus. This expense also funds salaries to the power plant engineers for a 24-hour, 7-day-per-week power plant operation, and a small maintenance staff to maintain the campus buildings and grounds. The budget adopted by the 2003 legislature assumed that the Brainerd campus would be vacated by July 1st, 2007, and no longer in the possession of the department. This means the department currently has a $1 million annual funding deficiency associated with the operation of Brainerd campus. This level of funding will need to be restored until the transfer or sale of the Brainerd campus occurs or the non-utilized buildings and infrastructure is demolished. The Brainerd campus has 13 major state buildings.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we move off that, and we met with the Capital Investment Committee, and I think you had kind of a short presentation because we had to leave, and thank you for that. During this capital investment tour this year, we experienced the the viewing of buildings that had been used by the state, for instance, it's specifically the regional treatment centers, and I think we relayed this to you at your short presentation. We believe the Capital Investment Committee was very concerned this year about the fact that the greenest building is one that already exists. And we did discuss when we went to the Agua Ching facility, which had previously been there and the county had some plans for it. The state spent $5 million to demolish that campus. And so what we viewed there was an empty site with no plans for the future for any reconstruction or development. We also visited the Wilmer Treatment Center, which has been all reused, and we visited with you for a short while in Brainerd. And I understand that you've had meetings in the past with the county and the city, and they've determined that they, at that time, I don't know exactly when those meetings were, maybe you can tell us, that they had no plans for reuse of those facilities. I think the Capital Investment Committee, and we have another member here, so you can tell me if I'm way off base, we talked about things having been changed in the past few years. We're being asked in some areas of the state, another area of the state, to build new supportive housing because there's a need for that, a type of supportive housing that the state would be involved in. We're seeing more and more homeless people, and so what I'm kind of wondering, with when you say the $1 million price tag for the entire campus, and that includes the minimal heat to the vacant buildings, have you broken out the cost for actually the minimal heat to the vacant buildings separated from the heating and et cetera for the other buildings that we are using? Have you separated that out? And that, is that a huge part of that $1 million, or is that just a tiny part of the $1 million, and maybe we should be thinking for the next few years about why we would be demolishing buildings when in fact we may have greater needs coming up, bubbling up to the surface from this great recession that we have, that we may need some use of those buildings in the future?
Mr. Van Buster.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is a really good question, and you made some good points, and it's somewhat of a complicated answer. The real answer hinges around the fact that the Brainerd campus is heated with the high-pressure steam plant. Requires 24-hour surveillance, 7 days a week, every day, every week of the year. This cost, just for manpower, exceeds $300,000 a year. So that's part of that $1 million. Our plan for the campus is to decommission this high-pressure steam plant and to install independent heating in the three buildings that are currently utilized by the state of Minnesota. Just the decommissioning the plant will save on labor over $300,000 of that $1 million that I spoke of. I don't have a breakdown for the individual buildings, but that's something that would be hard for me to come up with. Would have to be done through estimates because we don't have meters for individual buildings. But we could come up with a basic estimate for that and get that information to you. I would think that the key to the vacant buildings is probably over, and especially when you consider that the buildings, the two dark blue buildings on the screen, buildings 2 and 1, are really partially utilized right now. And I'd say they're between 15 and 20% utilized. Those two buildings are large square footage of the campus. The three buildings that we utilize are about 100,000 square feet. The balance, the 600,000, is for the rest of the buildings. And that hopefully, but by this time, by next fall, it's our plans to have those buildings, the steam plant decommissioned, and those buildings vacant and not heated. The problem with doing that is that non-heated building in Minnesota is going to start to deteriorate quite rapidly. These buildings are actually, the vacant buildings are actually deteriorating at even when they're heated. There's nobody going in or out. There's no air, very little limited air exchanges, and that part of that's on purpose so that we don't have to keep reheating the space in the building to try to keep our down. But when we do shut the heat off, those buildings will deteriorate much faster. There are ways to mothball the buildings, but to mothball the vacant buildings in the campus would be millions of dollars. So our plan would be abate the hazardous materials from the vacant buildings and then to demolish them. That's what our request is focusing on those buildings that are not used, and we really have not been able to find people to use them. Could there be other uses for them? We continue to seek ways to find reuse of the buildings. Next week, I'm meeting with another group on the Brainerd campus that wants to look at all of the vacant buildings with ideas for reuse. And we'd be pleased if we can reuse these structures. The problem is that we can't afford as a department to continue to spend that money that we don't actually even have in our budget to maintain these buildings until we would find some reuse. Because that could be this year, next year, or 10 years from now. And it puts us in a rather a large dilemma for our community.
Representative Scalzi.
This is a short follow-up. And I appreciate the fact you are meeting with other people to possibly look at possible reuse of those buildings. We did see an astounding use of the buildings in Willmar. And granted, they use Jobsy to some people. That may not be a popular program. To see what they did with the regional treatment center in Willmar was amazing by using Jobsy. It's just a humming place. They've got a lot of private industry in there. It's just a wonderful reuse of buildings that already exist. And they gutted those buildings and rebuilt them from the inside out, and the companies that are there are very excited about what happened there, and I would urge you to do as much as you can to do that. And I understand the budget constraints are tying your hands. There's no doubt that we're doing that to you, but I applaud the fact that you're working with people on possible reuse, and I encourage you to do more in the future.
Okay, would you continue? And
well, I'm just going to give you a quick overview of the current status of the Brainerd campus. We have 13 major state buildings, 700,000 square feet, 127 acres of land. Growing County owns one building, that's the red building on the drawing on the right of the screen. It's a 40,000 plus square footage. The county owns 4.69 acres. They use one wing in this building for a small detox program. They use a small area for a dietary program to support this small detox program. And the rest of this building is also vacant. And the county is not quite sure what they plan. So it really doesn't have any plans for future use of this building. We only use three buildings on this campus. It's 100,000 square feet. Building 20, these are the buildings that are in a light blue color. Building 20 is used for Minnesota care offices. Building 21 is for Minnesota neurorehabilitation services. And the building 22 is for a community addiction recovery program operated by state operated services. We have 8 vacant buildings. Those are the yellow buildings. They total, I think 100,000 square feet. And some of them have been vacant for 12, 13 years. Others, like building 4, we just actually moved out of this summer. However, that building was really underutilized. We had about 4 people in that building, and it's almost 70,000 square feet. So it just didn't make sense to have people in there this winter, and they were relocated into building 1, which is the old administration building. The old administration building, the blue building on the lower part of the drawing, and building 2, the building just above that. Building 2 is a service building. It had the dietary, the laundry, the warehouse, all the mechanical shops, and the high-pressure steam plant. The only thing we really have in there now is the high-pressure steam plant and several small maintenance shops. The rest of that building is vacant. Buildings 1 and 2 will become vacant when we complete the installation of the independent heating for the three buildings that are currently occupied. We hope to have that work done by the late summer or early fall of 2010. What's our plan for the Brainerd campus based on this, request is based on? It's to continue to seek opportunities to reuse and redevelop the Brainerd campus. And as I mentioned, next week I'm going to meet with another group. I talked to the local economic development people probably twice a month, if not twice, at least once a month. Ask if there's new ideas floating around, if anybody's talked about it. And they really push hard to try to find reuse. Unfortunately, in the circumstances in the Brainerd community, there's not a lot of economic activity going on. Crowing County has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state of Minnesota right now. My understanding is over 10%, and that has really hit the economics of that community at this point in time. Maybe in the future, that improves the options for these spaces to improve. But we don't know when that might take place. So, the second part of our plan is to reduce the operating expenses for the state by implementing first the installation of the HVAC in buildings 20, 21, and 22, and then to develop plans and specifications to abate hazardous materials and demolish the underutilized buildings. Stage two would be to implement the hazardous materials abatement and the demolition of the vacant non-utilized buildings, and we would do this in a progressive order. We wouldn't tear every building down, but we continue to try to find reuse for these buildings before we demolish them. But if we couldn't find it, then we would proceed with the demolition of another one or two buildings. And then this third phase would be to complete the abatement and demolition, including the demolition of buildings 1 and 2, the related tunnel system, and the basic infrastructure and reconfiguration of the campus. Funds remaining from prior year capital appropriations for system-wide redevelopment, reuse, and demolition will be used to complete stage one and to begin the work on stage two. Funds from this request will be used to complete stage two and to complete stage three of our plan. The department requested $5,782,000 for this project. The government recommends the department's request. The fourth priority is a program for
Representative Abler.
I know you're stretched for time, but I just have two questions about this. So there's enough money in this request to bulldoze all but four buildings here? Is that what you're telling us?
Mr. Van Busker.
Representative Abler, that's correct. With the residual balances we have from prior appropriations for this request.
Then the last question, that $1 million deficiency that you said came from 03, which, how come that didn't show up in a request for deficiency or something in the meantime? I'm just surprised that there's deficiencies that you're absorbing or something. Did that just get carried somewhere else in the budget, or it's a surprise to me, I guess, on that topic.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe that they're going to bring something forward to our request that $1 million be added to the department.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just surprised that we have a deficiency since 07 that just pops up now. I mean, somebody might have brought it up earlier, so we'll ask about that later.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if it was brought up before or not in the operations.
We're going to have to move along pretty rapidly.
Mr. Chairman. The fourth department priority is to design a 24-bed residential program for the Minnesota Sex Offenders Community Preparation Services Program. This building would be located on the northwest corner of St. Peter campus. The goal is to manage risk and gradual increases in liberty and individualized supervision for their patients. At the current rate, the CPS program that is in place now will be out of bed in 2014. The department requested $300,000 for developing construction documents and plan to request $3.5 million for construction in 2012. The governor did not recommend funding for this project. The last priority is for the design and development of a training office support complex on the NOCA Regional Treatment Center campus for state operated services. The remodeled space will be used as a statewide training center and support facility. funds for the renovation construction for this project were to be requested in the department's 2012 capital budget request. And the need is because of the disposition of the Wilmerford, Sinagogene, and part-time, the current downsizing of the Brandon campus. We really don't have any spaces available for training our outstate staff. This development of this training center will provide that space. In addition, the training center will provide a facility for state-operated professionals to learn and study in a clinical environment on the Wilmerford campus. The department requested $618,000 for the design. The governor did not recommend funding for this. With that, I conclude my presentation and take any
questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you can share with us job estimates for proposals 2 and 3.
Proposals 2 and 3?
The asset preservation and the Brainerd campus redevelopment.
Mr. Chairman Braxton, that's a really hard one, but we do have projects that we're ready to move on with additional funding. We have a balance in previous appropriation for asset preservation. Legislature was very kind to us last year and gave us $2 million. And that $2 million has been earmarked specifically for the upgrading required by code of the system's elevators. We have a little money left from prior years, and those monies are basically allocated to projects that we're looking at getting moving forward for spring construction. It's impossible for me to say, but there will be a number of jobs in mechanical, electrical, and roofing areas.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
And thank you for that. And I am wondering if it would be possible between now and maybe the start of the session if you might be able to give us a little tighter estimate on what you think the jobs produced, what that number would look like.
For those two projects?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll try to do that. So we're having a meeting, I think, this week with our finance directors, and we'll discuss this.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, I think we should go check out the cookie jars at DHS.
Well, Representative Murphy, it always amazes me that when we bond to demolish a building that no legislators show up for the, if you're going to build a building, they all show up, but if you're going to tear one down, nobody ever comes. So thank you, Mr. Van Busker, and let's move on to Representative Clark and the Hennepin County Hyperbaric Chamber. Sure, they're going to tell us, but this is the only one in the state. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, it's the only one in the state that is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and treats everybody from everywhere in the state. That's right. So, thank you. You started this off well. This is the bill that would provide $5 million in bonding for the County Medical Center to replace its hyperbaric oxygen chamber, and it is the number one priority of Hennepin County. It's a extreme need right now. The existing facility is breaking down and not serving the purpose that it's needed and depended upon. So I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Robert Collier and to Jan DeRoche, both people who are associated with the chamber, the hyperbaric chamber, and can tell us some of the details about it, and I'll be glad to answer some questions after they make their presentation. I believe there's a packet that's available for distribution. Do you all have that? Okay. All right, thank you. Dr. Clark.
Mr. Chair and committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Robert Collier. Excuse me, sir. A new phone.
That's
and I
never happened to me.
Actually, a new phone, and I thought I had diagnosed how to do this. But anyway, I'm sorry. My name is Dr. Robert Collier, and I'm one of the hyperbaric medicine staff physicians at Hennepin County Medical Center, for the record. I want to thank you very much for letting me testify to this committee, and I would like to make just a couple of very important points about our request. in securing funding for a new hyperbaric chamber and facility. My first major point is that the hyperbaric chamber at HCMC is a resource for all citizens of Minnesota. Any one of us or family members, as you've seen in the news many times, could need this life-saving specialized care at any moment. Chances are good that someone in each of the districts you represent received emergency treatment in our chamber in the last 18 months as we treated patients from 59% of the counties of Minnesota. And there's a map handout that actually should represent that to you. Hyperbaric medicine and oxygen is a specialized medical treatment during which a patient breathes 100% oxygen at increased atmospheric pressure. It has multiple therapeutic effects and is especially good in counteracting the effects of poisons such as carbon monoxide, cyanide, enhancing the treatment of severe infections, and in scuba diving accidents and other invasive medical procedures where air gets in the arterial system and can cause strokes and other bodily damage. At Hennepin County, we provide 24-hour emergency service for this. Two other facilities in the state do not do 24-hour coverage, though they do some emergencies, but we mainly are the emergency center for this type of specialty treatment. If our service were to close, Minnesota citizens would have to be transported to Milwaukee or Iowa City for emergency treatment, and the time delay in transferring these patients would be very detrimental to their outcome. Also, if we were to close, one might argue that some other facility might take up the banner and become the hyperbaric facility that does emergency care, but there's a couple of reasons why this probably would not happen, and there's really not much competition for this relatively low number of patients that we see. It's very expensive to provide the care for these patients. You need specially trained hyperbaric nurses, doctors, and technicians, and you need a hyperbaric facility that can do critical care. The third thing is you need a supporting hospital that must have sophisticated emergency surgical intensive care services for 24 hours a day. And, of course, HCMC is a hospital that does that as it fulfills its duty to be a public service and teaching and research hospital. Now, what emergency conditions do we treat? You should have a handout that has quite a few of the types of things that we do treat. Probably the biggest emergency, the most emergencies that we treat are carbon monoxide poisonings. We do about 100 of those a year with people with serious poisoning. Last November, as an example, when the weather turned cold and the furnaces were lit, we treated 11 people on one weekend for carbon monoxide poisoning. And I don't know if you appreciate what a devastating poisonous gas it is. Other than being fatal to a lot of people, it causes a lot of serious neurologic deficits, and if you do recover, and so you need prompt treatment for it to really recover from it, and that's what we provide. Other common causes are faulty heaters in campers, ice fishing houses, and in industrial settings. And most of the serious poisonings in Minnesota are accidental, and they come from rural areas, and a lot of them are transferred to our facility. The other life-threatening condition we treat a lot of is a necrotizing infection, also known as gas gangrene, and you may have heard the popular press describe it as flesh-eating bacteria. And this is another one of those things where you need a really good system and experts to treat this. We currently are treating a gentleman who had this exact problem involving his abdominal wall and chest wall. And due to the multiple disciplines that we have at Hennepin, he is doing much better after surgery, hyperbaric oxygen, and infectious disease and intensive care staff doing their thing. So it's an important thing. The other thing that we treat is cerebral gas embolism, which means cerebral, I should say, gas embolism, which is air getting in the arteries. Example of that was actually 11-year-old young man who was taking diving lessons in a pool at the University of Minnesota and ascended too rapidly and had this injury where he got air in his arteries and actually presented with a severe headache and paralysis of his extremities. Prompt treatment in the hyperbaric chamber reversed all of this, and of course he was fortunately very close to the chamber, and that helped too, make things resolve faster. A second major point is pretty obvious. We need a new hyperbaric facility at HCMC. The chamber has served us well for 46 years, but the building that houses it, the entire infrastructure, are in decay and have reached the end of their useful life. The facility was orphaned from the medical center when the new hospital was built and is two blocks away from the main campus. The aging facility began to have mechanical failures of multiple systems in 2007 to 2008, which threatened to compromise continuance of service and patient safety. Serious attention was directed to the need to replace the chamber in 2007-2008, with ACMC placing high priority to continue the service and replace the chamber with a modern one on campus. Moving on to campus also solves a lot of other serious problems, including avoiding ambulance and hallway and outdoor transport of critically ill patients, ready availability of the cardiac and code teams, radiology and lab, and all the other hospital services that are available to other parts, other services, but not to us readily because we're away from the hospital. It also is good for safety for our staff because they're coming in at all hours of the night and they're in a very remote place from the medical center and its security system. ACMC approved capital funding of $9.7 million to replace the chamber and renovate existing space in the hospital in around 2008-2009, but with the economic downturn, that had to be frozen. Despite that, we've had to spend about $750,000 on emergency capital just to replace failing equipment, just to keep the chamber going and to keep it safe. And that investment is estimated to last for approximately 1 to 2 years. So we're 1 year into that. So if we started the process today of ordering a new chamber and renovating the space for it, it would take 18 months from this point right now to do this. So we really must get funding for this chamber and actually the facility in general to benefit all the citizens of Minnesota. Could be life-saving for many. And I would really ask you to seriously consider this this request. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just ask general issues and this matter gets facing the
I'm just available for questions.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, if I could just say one thing. I had a personal experience with this chamber from with some constituents of mine. It happened to be probably about 10 years ago. East African family who lived in the community, their heat was turned off in their house, and they in order to keep warm, they brought in a charcoal burner, and in a short period of time, everybody was unconscious. And this family of 11 people, which included pregnant women and babies and elders, were all survivors because they were taken by ambulance to the chamber and treated. It would have been a very serious tragedy. Anyway, I just wanted to say that because I happened to know that family, and it made the world a difference, obviously, to them.
This question. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I'm looking at the map regarding the counties of origin, and I'm wondering if you can break down just a little bit further for me from the numbers, maybe, from the numbers of people that are in your care and from where they come. Are you getting people from all over the state? And how many people are coming from Greater Minnesota? How many people are coming from Hennepin County that are getting treatment in this chamber?
I mean, we get patients from all over the state. I mean, I can tell you that I can't break down in each county how many are there that came from there, but we can only give you an estimate that 59% of the counties are represented that patients have come from there. I'm not sure that totally answers your question. But
I can reference that 75% come from our state. Only 25% are Hennepin County patients.
So, Mr. Chair, you're saying that 75% of the patients cared for in this facility come from outside of Hennepin County?
Correct.
Thank you. And just one more question.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you help me understand what percentage are coming to you as a result of CO poisoning, and what percentage are coming as a result of wound care, et cetera? How much of this is related to emergency, like poisoning, and how much of it is related to chronic disease?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I might defer to Jan if she has a stats.
15% are emergency care, and the other percentage is routine care.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. I it's been a long time since I've been a hospital nurse, but took care of patients both as a med-surg nurse with a lot of wound conditions and then as a surgical nurse where we did surgical debridement. And I won't go into gory detail, but the wounds that we care for aren't anything that you might imagine. It's not a little wound on a toe, but very devastating conditions that are both life-threatening and devastating for the person going through the treatment. So I can't underscore, I think, the importance of the value of this for the state of Minnesota. And then just one more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have an estimate of the jobs created by the replacement of this chamber? And if you don't today, could you get that for the committee, please?
200.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. I had a meeting with Hennepin County Commissioner Saturday morning and others, and as you might guess, with a county as large as Hennepin, there were a lot of issues that we were talking about. But Mike Opat, who happens to be the chair of the county board, probably stressed this project more than virtually anything else on the legislative agenda for Hennepin County. And I think that was a signal of the importance of it. And also stressed that it is a statewide service.
Well, let me just comment on that. And we have to be very careful that we don't start funding non-state hospitals all over the state, because there's no end to that need. So we have to pay attention, and I, at least in my mind, I have to look at, is this really a state resource? And the next bill coming up with Representative Carlson is going to be a similar decision that we have to make. Representative Abler.
I was just going to be quiet about that, but since you raised the thing I was thinking about, I think of all the sites in the state, this is probably the one that rises to the level that has a grander need. I wouldn't think that my two hospitals up in my neck of the woods would be of a similar kind like that. But I think it's a good question to ask, and sometimes we buy community centers, and at least this is something that is, at least in terms of the value to the state, I think better than that.
Let me ask a question. Did the education building, was that ever built at Hampton County Medical Center? This is another issue like that, but Hennepin County does train almost all various professions in the state, and they asked for an education building a couple of years ago.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is David Godfrey, Public Policy Manager for HCMC. My understanding is that 2 years ago, I believe in the Bonney Bill, there was approximately $800,000 approved for planning and for a health sciences education building. Those plans have since that time been somewhat reworked, and I believe we've had communications with Representative Houseman and Senator Langseth regarding the possibility of not redirecting those funds, but to change the language in order to so they could be used for a scaled down version of that project.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to add to the rah-rah of that. I, even before this hearing, have become convinced of the importance of this project and learning of it some time ago. But just to underscore the point, can I ask the question? Maybe I missed it because I missed the first minute or so of the introductory remarks, but what other hyperbolic chambers do we have in this state or even in the upper Midwest region, and how far away is the closest one?
Dr. Collier.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have, Mayo has another chamber,
mm-hmm.
and that's a fairly new one.
Mm-hmm.
We actually train them, their personnel, mm-hmm. because of our 40-whatever years experience
mm-hmm.
of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are chambers at Abbott. That they only, they're monoplace chambers, they're small chambers, mm-hmm. single person, and they use those for wound healing.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, with Mayo, they will do some emergency treatments, but they're not available 24 hours, 7 days a week to provide that service. That's why ours is unique.
Okay. Just a follow-up question, then. The Mayo facility is also a multi-person, you know, room-type facility that you can treat multiple patients at the same time?
Mr. Chair, Representative, mm-hmm. That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Clark.
Yeah, I just want to say, in response to your concern about statewide relevance of this, I would point out again, I think it's a question that Representative Murphy asked earlier. 75% of the people who are treated with disabilities come from outside of Pennsylvania. So to keep that in mind, is really one I hope would be considered, you know, a statewide. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Next we have Representative Carlson. Who has left Hennepin County and come to Ramsey County. I said you have left Hennepin County and come to help Ramsey County with this bill.
That's correct, but you will learn that one of the counties that's major user of Gillette happens to be Hennepin County. So. And in fact, I had a meeting this morning where the relationship with Gillette happened to come up. That's just sort of a coincidence. Mr. Chairman, House File 2568, I'm going to give you a quick overview, and then we have others here that will testify, but this is a very unique hospital. This is a $20 million bonding request for Gillette Children's Hospital to renovate and upgrade its surgical suites to meet the growing facility needs to provide the highest quality of care for children with disabilities and to treat children with level one trauma from across the state. Gillette is a unique Minnesota asset established in 1897. Since its inception, Gillette has treated children with profound disabilities, half of whom are on Medicaid, and that's an important point that we'll be talking about later. Gillette is a statewide resource, annually treating patients from almost every county in Minnesota. Typically, that's 86 of the 87 counties is where the patients come from. The legislature moved Gillette from its former location on Lake Phelan to its current location in 1977. The real estate and building space are owned by Ramsey County. Gillette leases the space from Ramsey County, and you'll be hearing from one of the Ramsey County commissioners, Mr. Ortega, in a moment. As the owner of the facility, Ramsey County is making the request for $20 million to design, construct, furnish, and equip 8 new surgical suites at the facility. The surgical suites are one portion of the total project, which costs approximately $62 million. It is in its entirety. Gillette is moving its outpatient services to a new building across the street to make room for additional intensive care beds and additional surgical suites. Groundbreaking on that part of the other parts of the project that took place in October of 2009, Gillette has raised $42 million to pay for the project. And Gillette desperately needs $20 million this year to complete their expansion to meet the needs of the children that they serve. Gillette made the decision to start construction of the total project in October 2009 when people needed work. The surgical expansion, financed through state bonds proceeds, will commence in the fall of 2010, so it's also a fast-track part of this project. And Mr. Chairman, just as one additional footnote, we have 38 co-authors on this particular bill, so there is a lot of interest in attempting to move forward with the request. Did you want to comment now and then maybe introduce the others in the order that you'd like them to present?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee, my name is Margaret Perryman. I'm the CEO at Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. I've actually been in my position, it'll be 23 years next month. And to me, this is one of the most exciting projects we've ever initiated in for our institution. We were founded in 1897 by the legislature, and we were funded by the legislature until the mid-70s and became a private not-for-profit in 1989. As Representative Carlson notes, we do take care of children from virtually all the counties in Minnesota. Last year, we cared for about 20,000 children with disabilities, and of those 20,000, approximately 80% are from the state of Minnesota. A number of our programs are actually nationally and in some ways internationally recognized, and so we do see children from other states as well as other countries, but for most of our patients are from the state of Minnesota. I have with me today County Commissioner Rafael Ortega and Jim Hattigan, who's our Chief Financial Officer. Jim is going to start out by telling you a little bit more about the project and some of the details of it, and Commissioner Ortega will also talk to you about the county's point of view on this project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives, again, my name is James Hattigan. I am the Chief Financial Officer at Gillette. And as you've already heard, Gillette is a long-standing institution in the state, over 100 years old. Much of that time was actually a state hospital until about 20 years ago, as Ms. Perryman noted, and has worked with kids with disabilities. That is our exclusive specialty. Is kids with very disabling conditions. Often these are conditions that you don't find a great statistical amount of in the population, and so it is important that there's an institution that can bring all the expertise to bear on these types of disabilities. Again, as we've already said, we are a statewide resource. 50% of our Minnesota patients come from outside the Twin Cities area. And we see 86 to 87 of all 87 counties every year. In addition to that, we go out to see the patients. We have mobile outreach clinics, which we do run at a loss. We do over 200 clinics in rural Minnesota a year. And we estimate that we have saved our patients 3 million miles of driving in the last 10 years. So we'll make a claim for being green as well as being good. And we have a 24/7 resource line for patients and their families, but even more importantly, for the physicians, the community physicians, that they can call in and get expertise when one of their patients who has disabilities, who's been at Gillette, comes to them for perhaps some other care, and they want some opinions on how to perform that care in the context of that disability. The project, as we've already said, we're asking for the help because we have the highest number of Medicaid patients as a percentage in the state, over 50%. That's five times the state average. The problem that we're having is over the last 8 years, the reimbursement has fallen to a point where we are getting 61% of the costs of the care for those patients. We have lost nearly $41 million in the last 6 years, 10.8 of that just in 2009 alone. And that is really why we are here seeking help, is we cannot completely finance this project on our own. We have borrowed some money, but we've borrowed as much as we can. Bondholders are very nervous about lending money to hospitals that have high Medicaid for the reasons that I've just explained. And then the project itself, again, $64 million, renovation of our PICU, our surgery. This is desperately needed. There's a need for more pediatric intensive care beds in Ramsey County to support the Level 1 Trauma Center at Regions. Our surgical needs have been increasing, and we do have very old operating rooms that we originally acquired from Regions, so we do need to upgrade those rooms, and that is really what we're asking the state to help us with.
Mr. Ortega.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak before you today. First of all, I want to say that I'm here representing the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, who unanimously supports the endeavor that's undertaken by Gillette Hospital. We have a long history with Gillette Hospital that goes back to the 1970s, when it was originally a state facility. In the 1980s, when we began to renovate Ramsey Hospital, the state asked us to make room for Gillette Hospital in that facility and actually deeded us part of the property, and we will lease it back to Gillette Hospital. And then we, as you know, we've through the years have made a relationship with Regents Hospital and are very supportive of that facility. I sit on the board of Regents Hospital on behalf of Ramsey County. And we see both Regents and Gillette as a very valuable asset, not just to us, but to the state in terms of the health services they provide. The facility itself is owned by Ramsey County, and we lease it to Gillette Hospital in order to provide the services that many of our community needs. As was noted, over half of the people served by Gillette Hospital are on Medicaid. And that's critical as we look at the folks that we serve, not only in Ramsey County, but Hennepin County and throughout the state. I think most of the counties are served by Gillette Hospital. So, again, I just want to say that we, the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners, look at Gillette as a very valuable statewide asset. We look at it as a continuation of the relationship we have with the state over the years to maintain this facility and these health services for the for our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, one I've been asking a lot of. First of all, is the reason why your MA rate is so high is because of the nature of the disability of the patients in your care?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's many factors for the reimbursement. Yes, the care is expensive. Now, in Minnesota, inpatient care is actually costed to the facility itself. In the last 8 years, that has been degraded, and so the inpatient rates have gone down. What's more problematic for us is outpatient rates. Our outpatient rates cover about 33% of the actual cost. Those have not changed for a very long time, and they don't take into account the severity of the patients, as in our case.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. And we have been doing a lot of rate cutting. Your patient base has a high rate of disability. Is that correct?
Yes.
And is that rate of disability the reason why your patient base, so much of your patient base, is enrolled in medical assistance?
It is a combination both of qualification by being disabled, and but also we have a great number of people who are in the program through the low income.
And Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Murphy.
Thank you. Can you provide for the committee an estimate of the number of jobs created by this proposal?
Yes, I can. 874. Both that's construction jobs in putting the project together, and includes approximately about 50 new positions over the next couple of years at Gillette.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Let me ask, the phase one is underway, or is that completed?
Part of phase one is underway. This project requires staging of three stages. In order to do the surgery at the PICU, we have to clear room in the campus. We only have so much of it. So we are building a outpatient center across the street where we will be relocating much of our outpatient services. That will create the room for an increased size of PICU and also for our surgery. We are funding that first piece ourselves.
So overall, you're asking for $20 million from the state, but that is leveraged by another $44 million.
That's correct.
Let's see. Next, Representative Giblet.
Thank you. One of my favorite topics is about uncompensated care and losses. The chart you gave, which I appreciate, is that that's actually money? Was there below cost losses?
Yes.
So that's based on?
On the Medicaid program.
All right. Because there's, you understand the question, because there's some people compared to retail and some compared to what Blue Cross would have paid. But this is actual money that you
losses off cost,
right.
And using the Medicare cost report methodology, which is what the DHS uses when setting rates.
Thank you for that. And Mr. Chair, just an observation. If you add up the losses in 08 and 09, then they could have bought their own $20 million thing almost. So we asked these clinics and providers to work for, you know, beneath charity, you know, to run a business, and it's an amazing thing. And I'm happy to hear that, I have two more things. I'm happy to hear that you're remodeling existing space with the money, that's right. And so I think in this time when we're reducing, you know, when there's less jobs in the industry, if we can reuse the building, that's outstanding. And then one more question. This electronic medical record thing,
yeah.
Isn't there some money from the stimulus that can do that? And is that included in this? It would have been more but for that, or is this eligible for that?
The stimulus money is fashioned in such a way that if you achieve what's called meaningful use by a certain date, and that's not been entirely set for Medicaid yet, it has for Medicare, then you can begin to get some payments over a period of 4 years. But you have to actually have the EMR in place first. The other piece for us is the Minnesota requires a fully functional electronic medical record.
Representative Slowick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question is really to the author. I have a question. I know we've seen this bill before. We've seen this bill before in the city, and we do have the competition there to do.
If anybody has a cell phone, if you would turn it off for a little bit.
I think it just died. So Mr. Chairman and committee, it 2 years ago, we received $300,000 of planning money basically to help us plan this project. Last year in 29, when there was a bonding bill, that an emergency bonding bill, if you will, for job stimulus, we actually did submit this project in that bill, but we did not, we were not among the final recipients of funds for that project.
Chairman. And on some Rice County, Durable, Minnesota, and she had, I believe, 94 blood come to Gillette by your teacher in 2002. No, Steele County, Owatonna, and those folks as well. But from a personal point, I must again thank you for saving my grandson by 20 hours. He is now working as a productive member of the Minnesota Tech State and busing dishes and picking up a paycheck and paying taxes and having a wonderful time doing that. Loves his job. And when we had him at Gillette for a year, we did not think we would ever see him do anything of that sort. So thank you for the work you do.
The Chairman, Representative Fritz, I want to comment back to you. I first of all very much appreciate your comment about that. In 1897, when Gillette was founded by Dr. Arthur Gillette, one of the arguments he made to the legislature, and a point that still continues to be very important to us, is that in the end, we hope that we can help our patients, the children of Minnesota who are disabled, become members of the community and become citizens. That is the language that's right out of the founding records of our organization. I'm very good to hear that.
Last word.
Impacted by Gillette, and I've had an opportunity to meet some of them, and their testimony over the years is very positive. When I mentioned this morning that it came up, I happened to in my district experience, and when I was there, I happened to mention I had to leave a little early because of the weather to make sure I was here. And, they talked just in an anecdotal way as I was leaving about the positive relationship that they've had with Gillette through the years, and they wished me success. So thank you.
Thank you. And next is Representative Slawick. Welcome to the committee. You've been here for quite a while.
Thank you for fitting us in. I think we're last.
Yes.
So I appreciate if y'all can stay. Hopefully it will be short and sweet. We appreciate the opportunity to hear this House file, which involves the city of Maplewood to design, renovate, and equip the former St. Paul Monastery for use as a regional service center for domestic violence support and other services. Some of you are familiar with this project. The bonding committee actually toured it last year, and I see Representative Scully's done it. I think she's been there before. Have any of you been to the monastery? You might have heard the story of the sisters. The sisters prayed for it's built like they prayed and prayed and they. So much more than as many of you know, an innovative provider in fields of domestic violence legal support. So it's a really good opportunity to do this. What the difference between last time we had a bill and this time is that the city of Maplewood is now the fiscal agent. So with that, I'd like to have the manager accept that.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Antonin. I'm the new city manager for the city of Maplewood. And I really appreciate the opportunity for you to hear this bill because it's something that's very, in my opinion, very worthwhile. As city manager, I support this request of Tubman for the city of Maplewood to be the fiscal agent to receive the bonding money and to pass it through for this worthwhile project. As you may note in my letter, the council is taking this matter up tonight in a resolution to further back our support of it. And it's my inkling that that we probably will have a 5-0 vote in Maplewood, which is something of a rarity in current years. So, again, it's my pleasure to appear before you and fully support this amendment. And I think you know this is a good start of phase one of really a significant operation that have not only regional attention. Morning and our current entities have further needs. I think if these needs begin with, we can lessen.
Can you hear me better? I'm Beverly Dussault, and I'm president of Public. I'm here to speak briefly, on behalf of the City of Maplewood's $2 million bonding proposal for a regional multi-service center. Over 35 years of work in family violence, youth programming, and community mental health has led us to two key findings. First, when people come to us in crisis, they face multiple barriers. I mean, domestic violence, legal issues, parenting, traumatized youth, mental and chemical health issues, lost jobs, lost housing, many more, especially with this war. Second, collaborations provide the results. They just do. Services in silos won't address multiple needs fast enough. But a cross-discipline platform of services reduces barriers and brings about sustained change, we believe, faster for both individuals and families. This request responds to both of those findings and would provide a space for multiple challenges to be addressed in an effective and cost-efficient way. The project, and I mean this sincerely, and we've run the numbers several times, will save money, literally. Not only for Tubman, but for the state. You might take note of some of the things that are in the handout. We anticipate operational savings of nearly $200,000 annually as a result of consolidating our two shelters under one roof. Other savings will occur simply because as a result of having staff and two partners being co-located. Because we expect state funding, I'm sure you do too, to remain flat, if we're lucky. These cost savings will help us offset a nearly 50% increase in services since June of this year in all of our major services. And when you think we've got a 20,000 per year crisis call line, you can see the magnitude of the increase that we're engaged in. Tubman's first goal has been increasing access to services because we're committed to crisis prevention, not just intervention. In the long haul, we know that preventing crisis saves vast amounts of healthcare dollars, public safety dollars, police time. Indeed, we know it saves lives. It might even save our children's futures. Preparing this regional multi-service center will substantially increase access to our broad array of services and those of partners we anticipate using the facility with us. The entire project is grounded in fiscal responsibility. The building, formerly St. Paul's Monastery, was actually Ramsey County's bomb shelter until about 15 years ago. It's very safe, and it still has 160 years of usable service in it. We purchased it at a fraction, as you know, of its real value, thanks to the sisters, making just necessary safety and security improvements will assure use of a 100,000 square foot facility. 100,000 new resource, not just for Tubman, but for statewide users and other collaborators across the region. This small investment, in turn, will permit community members and citizens to overcome their barriers as soon as possible. The scope of the project goes far beyond Maplewood city limits. Tubman has always served the entire East Metro area. But this center will also house a nationally significant learning institute and provide like agencies with findings and best practices in shared areas of expertise. Tubman is known for innovation and change. This undertaking will create the springboard from which we can increase that kind of learning and research and collaboration. Additionally, this will allow us to leverage existing community partnerships and create new collaborative inroads, both public and private. Just as a small example, Tubman already works with 18 East Side law enforcement offices and departments, sheriff's offices and police departments, several of which may office in the facility with us. And we hope to add, if we're lucky, a research evidence-based community health center as well.
As such, the space will serve as a hub for our network of 200-plus pro bono attorneys, more than 200 interns from over 50 regional colleges and universities, and a 500-plus volunteer base beyond. Maplewood City Manager Jim Antonin is already creating regional collaborations to build further community services and collaborations out of this center, as well as what is already going on in Maplewood with us. As a nonprofit, we know the necessity to leverage volunteers and partnerships. This project has been structured to maximize that as it relates to systems, communities, and even academic engagement in the future. I sincerely hope you'll see the value in this proposal. It's a fairly small amount of money that could make a very, very significant amount of leveraged difference in both people, services, and dollars. And we think not just the quality of life for the people of Minnesota, but as well for the state's health care and human services finance division in your deliberations, as you have to distribute the very few dollars you have. We'd really appreciate your consideration and being part of this bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, very much for your consideration of what we think is a vitally important project.
Representative Slawick. Or Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Over there.
And I would like to reiterate what I had said before. The greenest building is one that already exists, because you don't have demolition costs, you don't have manufacturing costs for new materials. The jobs would be in redevelopment and reuse rather than in destroying and recreating. And not only that, but it preserves our heritage rather than tearing down our heritage, which we sometimes seem to forget about.
Any other questions? Representative Abler.
I have an Alexander House in my neighborhood, which is that something comparable to what this is?
Alexander House is a terrific shelter in the state. There are 27 shelters totally in the state of Minnesota. Just because Tubman has gone through both a major consolidation with what was Family Violence Network and Chrysalis, the Center for Women, a recent merger, we are substantially larger. But they do some of the things that we do indeed, yes.
Okay, well, it's in the right department anyway, so thank you. And it seems like, you know, there's a lot of worthy projects this year, if you... And that your author knows that too. Is there this is just a year to keep thinking of options and more options. And if you only got half the money, or if you didn't get the money, what happens?
Well, we need minimally this plus what we will match it with to make the building operational. Move out of the two current shelters that we're in that are extreme. That's where the $200,000 comes from. It comes from transportation costs from all the way from Cottage Grove to Forest Lake, both getting clients to the professionals and the professionals to the clients, plus the rent and the utilities, etc., for the buildings that we're currently in, which are unbelievably inefficient. So we know we have operational savings if we can apply it, and if we're going to try as well for some stimulus money, green stimulus money, which we think is paybackable within, that's not a word, forgive me, that the payback is within a 4-year period, very, very substantial. So it's going to continue costing us out of pocket, straightforward as we go forward, if we cannot assemble the dollars now. And in terms of numbers of dollars leveraged for the numbers of dollars invested, it'll be an extraordinary thing, both for the services that we provide, but as well for the education and training of all the interns that we're working with routinely now.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
yeah, I think I've heard this question.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I'm wondering if you have an estimate on the number of jobs that would be created by this project.
I wish I did after I had listened through this hearing and your question to those before me, Mr. Chair and member. I know that it is, I've been told it's not shovel ready, it's hammer ready, since it's
for Design Cement. But I know that it would be an instant for all the construction jobs and the engineering jobs and all of the subs. That's ready to go.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, we can get you a more firm estimate.
We will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I don't see any other questions, so thank you. You can get the last word there, Representative Slava.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. I know you all have a lot of deliberations and there isn't a lot of money. I hope you will consider this in your recommendations. We know there will also be a difference between the governor's recommendations and our recommendations, so we're hoping Representative Abler might be able to work out a deal on that one. There's some food for thought. But this is a very important project that, you know, we hope to get some money or it has to go forward at a slower pace, yeah. But it is an amazing facility. There's also senior housing right at that same place, and I hope at some point each of you would be able to come and visit it and see what the good work that Tubman does. And as Mr. Antonin talked about, do that prevention. You know, if we're ever going to break that cycle of violence, they're going to do a learning and teaching institute about what happens to families, how to prevent that, how to save the state money in the long run. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And for the members that are here, and Dan will send a memo out to those that weren't here, what we need is your priorities. I think you probably ought to rank them like 1 through 3, and we'll sort of total up and see what each one of these gets. And then when I get those, I will have to write a memo to Representative Hausman and her committee with what this committee's recommendations are. Representative Slawick.
Skelzy, Mr. Chair.
That's okay.
But I'm happy to be, you know, confused with Nora Slawick. But anyway, could you also include in that maybe a little bit of detail about what the governor's recommendations are?
Sure.
So that we have.
Well,
that.
We don't know for sure yet.
Well, he has his gut bonding recommendations. Yeah.
Okay.
And I know I have that because I'm on the bonding committee, but it might be helpful for the rest of the committee to have that.
Okay, we will do that. And it's been suggested that we rank them 1 through 4, not 1 through 3. So, with that, the meeting is adjourned.